This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Thank you. I'm Lawrence Weschler, and it's a great delight today for me to be able to introduce Breyten Breytenbach, the remarkable South African and, at this point, middle world, as he would call it, cosmopolitan poet and painter. Breyten was born in 1939 in South Africa, and as we were just discussing offstage, since then, everything with occasional minor interruptions has been going downhill everywhere. He was born in 1939, he died in 1960, he died in 1975, and he died in 1982. I first met him shortly after the third death in 1984 at the Penn Congress in New York City, where he was. I was sent by the New Yorker to do a talk piece, and he just was an amazing, amazing presence there. He had just a few years earlier emerged from 7 years in South African prisons. He engaged there in a forceful debate, among other things, with Mario Vargas Llosa. And I decided to do a talk piece about him. We agreed to meet on the last day of the day after the Penn Congress was over, and he was all talked out. He just couldn't say anything else, and so we decided instead to take a walk up to the Metropolitan, and just in silence we kind of walked up through the snow-covered Central Park to the Metropolitan, and in silence, along with his wife Yolanda, we walked through the galleries, and eventually we came upon a Vermeer, that wonderful Vermeer of the woman holding the silver pitcher with the blue dress and with the map behind her. And one of the first things Breyten said at that point was, he said, "Look at the date." And I looked, and it was 1660. And he said, "It's amazing to think that from all that serenity emerges the Boer." And then he points at the map. He says, "Look, that's them leaving right now on the boats." And indeed, 1660, the name Breytenbach appears in the records of the Cape Colony as early as 1656, which is to say almost from the very start. The Breytenbach and the other side of the family, the Clotes, have been long borders, residents of Africa. And he was raised in this fairly poor but vividly Afrikaans family, and eventually, very unusual for an Afrikaner, went to university in Cape Town in the arts, which was not a very Afrikaner thing to do, and, as I say, died his first time in 1960 when he boarded a steam tramp trawler and went up to Europe. In Europe, he was painting and he was writing poetry and very quickly becoming acknowledged as one of the great, great poets of that language and of the new generation. And soon after meeting and marrying Yolanda, a Vietnamese woman, and thereby becoming an exile because he had fallen on the wrong side of the race laws they had together, he also became one of the great, great writers of erotic poetry in the Afrikaans language, which drove the Afrikaners especially crazy that the language was being used in that fashion. He also became more and more politically active, especially after 1968, still staying in Paris, and gradually began to feel that painting and poetry were not enough. In 1975, 16 years after he'd left South Africa, he returns incognito on a political mission, which is pretty much botched from the beginning, and he is soon arrested. He had been traveling incognito, but they'd apparently known he was coming. They arrested him at the airport as he was trying to leave. He tells the story about walking by the glass walls and looking at his face in the mirror and the horror of that moment. Elsewhere he's written, looking into South Africa is like looking into a mirror at midnight when one has pulled a face and a train blew its whistle and one's image stayed there, fixed for all eternity, a horrible face but one's own. It seems to me that that's true not only for him but for all of us. At any rate, he was put on trial. He was a wonderful prize for the Afrikaners, you know, this man who had been taunting them all these years. A horrible, horrible trial, and eventually he was put in prison for part of that time in solitary confinement, a generally calamitous situation. Yolande kept returning from Paris to South Africa to be with him as much as she could, you know, even though they weren't able to touch on opposite sides of the wall. Suddenly, after considerable lobbying, well, I should say, by the way, that while he was in prison, he eventually was in Paulsmoor Prison and was in charge of some of the supply stuff for, among other things, the new prisoner who had arrived from Robben Island, Nelson Mandela. In any case, he was released in 1982. He comes back to Paris, having died the third time. Has a very hard time starting painting. The first painting he did was a painting of himself with his eyes closed, looking in the mirror. And I asked him why in the painting his eyes were closed, and he said, because I couldn't stand to look at myself yet. He also wrote a remarkable memoir of the prison time called The True Confessions of an Albino Terrorist. He shows up at Penn in 1984, and at some level you could imagine why it might be a sensible thing for such a person just to give up on South Africa completely and never to think about returning at all. But instead, he really poured himself into the struggle all over again, in particular founding an institute on Goree Island off of Senegal, the slave island, where he tried to, a Pan-African institute, he tried to bring Africans of all sorts, including Afrikaners, but French-speaking Africans, English-speaking Africans, and so forth together. And in 1987, he was centrally involved in putting together a secret meeting between members of the ANC and members of the Afrikaner business community that took place on that island. And that is very much considered one of the key moments that leads to the eventual decline and fall of apartheid, such as it was. He has written, and he'll talk to you himself about many, many, many books of poetry and of prose. He's a remarkable painter. He now spends his time partly during the fall season at NYU, but he's based in Paris, and when not there, he has a farmhouse in Spain, and when not there, on Goree Island, and when not there, back in South Africa, near the place where he was born. He is thrice dead, but very, very much alive, and I give you Brayton Breytenbach.
Thank you.
What happened?
Good evening, everybody. I couldn't hear very well what Ren was saying, but I'm sure it's all wrong. So I'm going to try and put the record straight, read from different books over the years. But seriously, I'd like to thank Lenin Foundation for having invited me to be here tonight. It's the first time. Thank you, yes. It's the first time for me to be in Santa Fe, in New Mexico, for that matter, and it's quite a wonderful experience. It's absolutely wonderful. If for nothing else, I'm grateful to have had this opportunity, this chance to see a little bit of your city and your environment. I want to thank everybody who made this possible. I want to thank my publishers here tonight, and I'm going to be reading one of my publishers, Archipelago Books. I'll be reading some bits and pieces from the various books that she's published over the last number of years. I want to thank Ren very warmly for, not for what he said here now, which I couldn't hear, but for having been a wonderful friend over many years. Not only that, but he's somebody whom I really deeply admire as a writer and as a thinker and as a social activist. And it's always been very stimulating, exciting to be in contact with him. So there are all kinds of reasons why it's a pleasure for me to be here tonight. Now, I brought a whole big bag, but I promise you I'm not going to be reading everything. It sounds, or it looks rather intimidating when you see all these books. In fact, I'm intimidated myself, so I'll try and keep it short. A little bit later on in the evening or in the reading, I'd like to read from a work called All One Horse. And we are lucky that we're going to be having some of the images that go with the book projected on stage. Well, originally, I was going to start off reading from there, but now I won't do that. I'll start with something else. Let me start with a short text that comes from a recently published volume called Intimate Stranger, which is really a collection of notes and small essays that arose from interaction with the students that I've been working with over a number of years in New York at University of NYU. This particular little essay is called Water Walking. And I was trying to imagine if I had to propose to them what was it that we were going to be working on over the ensuing semester, this is what I would have liked to propose to them. If I were to propose a course, I'd say that the coming pages would not, properly speaking, be a discourse on poetics, but rather a few causeries around poems, approaching the edge of sanity from whatever side, with a balance of curiosity and tactful distance, if not distaste. The less you know, the more tactful and circumspect you ought to be. It would be neither the history of any particular period or tradition or mode, nor that of any given poet. The situation of the poem may be highlighted, though, for there are many places of poetry, magic, mysticism, youth, the public forum, breath, history, memory, loss. There's also the place of diamond shining. Of central concern will be the function or the workings. Poem is as poem does, and I think One paradoxically learns the how of poetry long before understanding the why. Writing is a process of creating consciousness and thus the making of a self, because awareness is expressed through a vector, however abstract. The nature or intention of that self is of secondary concern. In so doing, I'd want to look at some contradictory givens. The poem, as disorderly and unlawful as reality, the poem predicated upon breaks in an attempt to encompass or imitate a whole, a stilled movement or moving stillness. You see, the position of the poem may change, but the problem is the same ever since breath became audible and visible incantation. Poem is a capsule of space and time. It is always finished. You can no less add to it than you can detract from it, yet never complete it until such time as it has been consumed or consummated by you, the reader. Sure, there will be as many original versions as there are readers, since each partaker uncovers her own reading. Poem is self-enclosed in its thingness, and yet it will always depend on the reader for final and total completion. The world is full of strangers. Finally, it is a simple equation playing with invisibles and unsayables, as if these could be seen and said, and they are as consciousness running away through words that can carry but not keep. The word becomes world, dense and explosive, but the sense, the education and the reach depends on or is triggered by the between words all those other components and contingencies making up the verse, prosody, line, shape, texture, harmony, dissonance, silences, ruptures. The function of the poet is to fuck the words good and hard. The practice of poetry, as opposed to the coming about of poem, may on the other hand be described as an idle sport framed by the indignities of time. Grown men do it so as to buy cigars, women new garters. With the above in mind, one would want to trace notions and mechanisms of consciousness as flickering in the writings of the Chinese ancients, of Rambo, Lorca, Celan, Vallejo, Pound, and examine presence, absence, and empty fool of how poems are written in the possible tense. Can we say that the object of writing poems is to create a microcosm more true than nature itself? In which case we are involved in the restitution of vital universal breath. Do we go about this by grasping the internal lines of things which we represent and thus to fix the relations which they have to one another? But these force lines can only come into becoming or incanted to incarnation on a background of emptiness or the void. Nothing belongs to the trait, not even its own trace. The outline retraces only borderliness, intervals, a spacing grid with no possible appropriation. That's a quote from Jacques Derrida, his Memoirs of the Blind. Therefore, in poetry as in the universe, without the void, no circulation of breath, and thus no shaping of opposites that together ensure harmony. And so one can say that harmony is not possible without movement. How do you know that my kind of traveling doesn't rejuvenate me in some obscure way? Fernando Pessoa asks in a text called A Voyage I Never Made. Or again, later in the same text, my salvation lay in interspaces of unconsciousness, emptiness, expectation, resonance must be built into the verse, indeed, into the very word. Then, when writing arrives at the point of being self-evident, without traces or footprints, it will appear to be as natural as to be a natural emanation of the paper, which is itself emptiness. This invisible written, that which has come about in a page, the ejaculated seed, the spilling of whiteness, will prolong and purify the off-page or the beyond page, conscious of the white, containing the black, the way to mystery. This was said by Wang Pinhung in reference to painting. In this context, we then look at the nature of the poet, how writing is a means to inventing itself, even that first person singular whom we sometimes meet and grimace at in the mirror. The seeing eye sees itself blind. We look at the dangerous ways in which a line defines, calls forth, confines the future. We try to observe the poets as shaman, as healer, historian, magician, agent of transformation, chameleon. We encounter the poet as outlaw and as terrorist. We move forward. Only the Tao, tracing, uncovering, writing, walking the flow, can obviate or wipe out the Dharma, which is the law, which is teaching. Ren referred to this, went into strange places in the course of my life. But before going to prison, I've been active in anti-apartheid activities. We were facing the situation that many of the people who were in prison, political prisoners, were at that point being tortured. And when one says torture, I suppose one should call it, what do they call it these days? Interrogation? Extreme interrogation, or some kind of euphemism that I've heard about. But it always comes down to the same thing. It's always torture, and it's always unacceptable. I wrote a poem in the form of a letter to the man who was at that point the Minister of Justice in South Africa. His name was Balthazar Foster. It didn't stand me in good stead a few years later when I ended up in prison myself, but I'll tell you about that in a moment. Letter from abroad. Letter to butcher from abroad. The prisoner says, "Now I'm not sure whether the sweet Lord roared, but the first fly is dancing, droning against the panes, a blossom tossed against the sky. The walls glisten with blood. One's heart hangs still for fear this ecstasy might ebb. One gathers the minute bewilderments as food for the journey of the ungainly grey human squatting, incarcerated in the body." The prisoner says, "Li Shangyin warned against holes for the rain. Never let your heart unfold with the flowers of spring. One inch of love is an inch of ashes. I hope you will pick out my grey bones in the blown fires of the earth. As for me, I'll set out on a trip. I lie inside my body on the upper deck to feel the tremors of the boat in my flesh. The ropes dozing all prepared in cool places. The mast will swing for direction against the blue. The sea will stir, the sea will smell, the sea will be alive with dolphins. Gulls will come to swarm above the heart. And then it'll all be silence to light a sun with the sounds of a language rapes each fiber, grain and cell. But I will go on a voyage." The prisoner confesses, "When your dreams are finally crushed and you await nights darkening far from your people, like the pine tree painfully yearning for a blaze of sails, its lament shuddering a white wind in a forest, to crouch on Monday mornings crippled like a crow at the lips of the ocean, then one is ready to tremble in the soil and feed the insects with confessed declarations. I can testify. I can describe the colors from within. The walls are black, the snot is gold, blood and pus are ice cream and berry juice. Outside against the bulwarks, the bird pecks and pecks. I stand on bricks before my fellow man. I'm the statue of liberation with electrodes tied to my balls. I try to scream light into this obscurity while writing slogans in crystal urine across my skin over the floor. Throttled by the ropes of my guts, I slip on a bar of soap and break my neck. Kill myself with the evening paper, tumble from the 10th floor of heaven to redemption in the street among people. And you, butcher, burdened with the security of the state, what are your thoughts when night begins to show a skeleton and the first burbling scream is forced from the inmate as if for birth, flooded by the fluids of parturition? Are you then humbled by this blood-smeared thing with its humanoid shattering shocks and its broken breath of dying in your hands? Does the heart also tighten your throat when you pour its slippery limbs with the very hands that will caress the secrets of your wife? Tell me, butcher, so that the obstetrics you've made to perform in the name of my survival may be revealed to me in my own tongue." The prisoner says, "I don't want to die here. I want to be hanged outside in the desert with my heart turned towards dawn's cold, where the mountains of flies gorging themselves on the horizon, where sand burns with 1,000,000 silver tongues and the moon is rotten as a shipwreck sinks through blue smoke. Now tell me, butcher, before that thing becomes a curse and you may plead only by mouths of graves before the risen prisoners of Africa." One was entitled to one letter a month and one visit, depending on the category or the grading they gave you in prison, but that was what it was like for political prisoners. And for the first 2 years, I was kept in a prison in Pretoria. We called it Beverly Hills, maximum security. It was also the place of execution. And the executions, this took place once a week on average, sometimes up to 7 people at a time. And the men who were due to die, sometimes women as well, were kept in a communal cell for the last few days when they'd be singing right through the night. And then they'd come down the corridor in the morning, shackled, to be taken to the room where they'd be hanged. And, of course, everybody would be very quiet and standing behind their doors listening to this. I must add immediately that I'm immensely proud, if for nothing else, that South Africa has abolished capital punishment. This is a letter that I received from my wife when I was in prison. Your letter is larger and lighter than the thought of a flower when a dream is a garden. As your letter opens, there's an unfolding of sky, word from outside, wide spaces. I slept in green pastures. I lay on the cusp of the valley of the shadow of death during the last watch of the night, listening to those condemned to die being led through tunnels in the earth, how they sing. With the breath of their lips as residents at the point of leaving a city in flames, how they sing, their breaths like shackles, how they sing, they who are about to jump from light into darkness, they who will be posted to no destination, terror fills me at a desecration. The table before me in the presence of my enemies is bare. I have ash on my head, my cup is empty. And I fled to your letter to read of the orange tree decked out in white blossoms opening with the sun. I could smell it on a balcony. I can smell you, lovely and lighter than the thought of a flower in this dismal night. I will be suspended from the sky of your words. Granted, I may dwell in your letter all the days of my life. Your letter is wonderful, larger and lighter than the thought of a flower when a dream is the earth of a garden. As your letter opens, there's an unfolding of sky, word from outside, memory. There have been enough studies made of the effects on people of long-term isolation. For my part, I think I should like to divide it into two kinds. One is the obvious one. Parts of you are destroyed, and these parts will never again be revived. You're altered in your most intimate ways exactly because all objectivity is taken away from you. You watch yourself changing, giving in to certain things, becoming paranoid, staring at the wall, living with an ear at the door and yet cringing at the slightest noise, talking to the ants, starting to have hallucinations without ever being able to ascertain the extent of these deviations or this damage, precisely because you have nothing against which to measure it. And this damage is permanent, even though you learn to live with it, however well camouflaged. You've seen them, Mr. Investigator, those who've been through camps and salt mines and breakwater building, as we refer to no man's land jails, and you marvel at their serenity and their conviviality. But just make them jump and you'll see how brittle their eyes are. You don't really know what they do behind closed doors, do you, Mr. Investigator? You don't know of the bitterness under their tongues, of how they watch the doors. Isolation has made me sick of myself and sick of others. And then there's the second kind. By being forced to turn in upon yourself, you discover, paradoxically, openings to the outside in yourself which you have not been aware of before. You grow rich with the richness of the very poor. The smallest sign of life from outside becomes a gift from heaven to be cherished. You really see things for what they are, stripped of your own overbearing presence. A blanket really is a blanket, and though it is gray, it has a million colors in it. A bird, when it comes to nest at night in the gutter running around the outside of the roof, really does make a very wide range of comments, and it has a rich relationship with its partner. You roll and smoke a cigarette, and its aroma is worth all the valleys of Turkey. You find a brown chrysalis in a small courtyard, like a finger of gold. Already it is wriggling. You take it inside and you watch the fascinating birth of a death's head moth, how it waits, still tame to the touch of the world, for its wings to dry, and when it takes off, a whitish spot the size of a 1 cent coin is left. No king was ever as blessed as you are. The days aren't long enough. You learn how things, appearances fit together, about illusion, about stopping and space, and you yourself just one vibrating pretense among many. That you outline absence by placing and fixing anything. You look at the wall and you see the battles between Saracens and Christians for Jerusalem, and you see a beach whale and how it is burned down for oil, and you realize your eyesight is weakening. At night, you lie looking at a weak bulb very high against the ceiling. You get to know the placing of that bulb very well, and someone comes into your cell. It's Fyodor Dostoevsky, scruffy and unshaven, with black dirt on his fingernails, wrapped in a coat so sloppy that he must have filched it from some locker in the station. And he never says a word. You describe your cell and all your little utensils to him, how crowded your life is. And it becomes too much because you must then also enumerate everything which isn't there. Isn't there-ness relativity? You tell him minutely about what has happened to the world since his departure. He utters not a word. Night passes like a whispering. You promise to finish for him that poem in the Brothers Karamazov, which he never got around to writing, that one about the return of Christ. You learn about rhythm and about balance, how nothing is sacred or personal, because the warders come, or the boorers we call them, come to skut. That is, they shake you down, and they cell search and body search you 3 times a day, turning everything inside out. You learn that all is sacred, since everything regains the value of having been touched, despite the repeated desecrations. You lose interest. You sleep and you dream that Kashyapa sent for you to reveal to you the teaching of the sky, a dynasty of patriarchs passing nothing from generation to generation, taking care not to lose it. You dream that the mattress is emptiness. You wake and in the dark you write a poem to the man who held up a flower by way of transmitting it, the only all. You enter the temple to help him die by holding down his head when he goes for the final somersault. You wake. It is quiet. Everyone is awake. Not a sound in the night but for the lone voice singing. You remember that this week only one is due for hanging. What a shame to choke off such a beautiful voice. Lord, I'm coming home, coming home, coming home, never more to go. Let me read from another little volume called Lady One. Let us jump time, let us go beyond death, let us go beyond birth. This one, I was on a visit with my wife to Vietnam. It was 1995, and we went to visit the grave of the forefather in a little village quite close to the Chinese border. Visiting the forefather's grave at Baksheng, 4th of December, 1995. Wind from the north brings cold dust to the city. The skies are gray. Today, dragon-crested mountains will be invisible. The route will take us to within a shout of the Middle Kingdom, over bumpy roads along endless columns of peasants with handkerchiefs masking nose and mouth. Sampans are ticks sucked to Red River's broad flow. Buffalo with a long gray shimmer of mud and ash strain their furrowed pleats through wooden plows across mirrors to turn over the sods and stain red the water. Everything must grow and live from the dying. This is no man's land, always threatened by invaders. Some houses are torched black, and then there are soldiers with red stars and green cloth. Flags slap the wind from tall bamboo poles. A few natives know the odd expression or two from beyond the border. Now and then one sees an alien word picture stenciled on a captured barbarian vehicle. At the edge of the settlement, imagined by the ancestor and populated from his loins, lies the farm where his descendants still live. Magic write signs like the memory of moths against rafters. A distant relative sucks blackface on a hookah. From the pigsty, flies come swarming and clouds close off the skyline. The woman has black lacquered teeth. The grandchildren are brimming with eyes. In a nearby field, his tomb is a threshing floor bordered by pawpaw trees, sugarcane, sweet potato runners. We arrange a bouquet of joss sticks and a tin of rice, and a cold wind from the north hustles the fragrant smoke shoots aslant past the muttering of our remembrances and our hands prayed palm to palm. He lurks well here, first slip and seam between stillness and the void. The arable plains belong to the living, the dead have taken to the hills. On a knoll there's a pagoda blotted behind a screen of bamboo and moke flowers. The yellow walls are stamped black by mushrooms of mold and butterflies from a foreign tongue. The gate is bolted and the grave's weeds smothered. We shout and hammer against the rotten wood of the door, but the deaf abbot with his grey unthoughts squatting in the shrouded prayer hall before the shining presence of thousand-armed Kuan Yin will not hear our breaths behind the wind. Let me read you a short text from a volume called All One Horse, and I believe we're going to have some of the images that go with the book projected on a screen. I need to tell you that these images, 27 of them, going with 27 short prose texts, rather like prose poems rather, they do not necessarily interact directly. They do not illustrate one another, although I hope they complement one another or they enhance one another. This particular short text is called Andes Mura. I wish to introduce you to my twin brother. If I haven't spoken of him any earlier, it is only because he has been until now quite content to live in my shadow. He doesn't eat very much. Now that he is to appear in broad daylight, I should like to give him a helping hand. Perhaps I should say, re-emerge like a shadow from the night, because this brother, in fact, set foot in Urwas long before me, and he still has here a network of friends unknown to me. Since that time immemorial, it is true, I had eclipsed him. And as this is a feudal state where success is a story of pulling strings and drawing straws, that is to say, of having an obsequious spine and a ready dirk, I ought at least to try and light him on his way. When we were born, my parents were right short on originality, which is why they named him simply Brother. Physically, he is my spitting image, to the extent that when he does a self-portrait, I often wonder whether he's not trying to picture me. I forgot to specify that he's a painter. Let me tell you about his favorite painting. It's the Mona Lisa, or La Gioconda, as some people think they know it. Why do you like that one best, I ask? Because it's a self-portrait, he answers. More precisely, because it is a painting of myself. I mean it. You smile? Look at my smile and then try to remember. Isn't it exactly the same? And the trees and the rocks in the background, the dead fish light all over, are they not elements of my mind? Some people claim that the thing was done by Leonardo, painting himself without a beard. Bullshit. Did you see him do it? And anyway, Leonardo is a figment of the communal imagination. When I die, I shall leave my portrait to the king. Of course, one can no longer see the painting as it has become invisible. Too many people with framed expectations have looked at it. When a thing is looked at too often, it loses its reality. Too many eyes kill the light and fade the pigment. But that suits me fine. In this way, it has become a mirror. The original black mirror. Bring it to your face. Can't you see the self-portrait? We've been around the world together. We share and share alike the same experiences, or so very nearly, that you may have been fooled. But you will never believe it, since we have reacted in such totally different ways. Perhaps it is due to his being so much younger than I. Or is it a matter of language? Each tongue is its own boat looking for its own sea. Sometimes it sinks under the dead weight of memories. I find him a little primitive still, primary you may say. He's the hunter of images. I never know what he thinks, and it is hard for me to pinpoint his Africanness. I do know that he is dying to die in a tree like an unfolding of blossoms, that he loves the deserted streets of night and the dead fish light of this town. My wife quite likes him. He may not be the most handsome man or woman on earth, but at least he's not intelligent. He, in turn, probably considers me already too smooth by the life of a shiny face in a distant land where you have to explain yourself to be understood, where it's fashionable to be à la mode, where images must be codifiable and digestible. He doesn't eat very much. I sincerely doubt if my displaced brother will succeed in being inserted among you, or that it will ever enter your mind. But I shall nevertheless try and give him his chance with these words of presentation and with this mirror. Good. Goya. Francisco de Goya y Lucientis, with candles on the rim of his hat, straddles the rim of a dark century, dark horses, my beloved. Mouth blind in a scream of terror, a death stone in the head of a dog squinting over earth's hump, and inscribes his black paintings on plaster of house walls, the house of the deaf, masks on the rotten rolling moon, my beloved. Black as blood, black as bread, black as murder, black as chaos, black as execution, white like the fire flashing from the muzzle of the gun, the bull smothers in his own blood, life as quicklime, muffling the bones. From dark heaven arises a carnival of cripples, condemned ones, a flare of ghosts. His hand remembers, does the hand still remember the fawning of idiot king and retarded princesses? The bayonet in the freedom fighter's gut, the crowning of the sardine, remember still the slender outline, the pale flesh in a dark fleece of Maria del Pilar Teresa Cayetana, de Silva Alvarez de Toledo, la Duquesa de Alba, my beloved. His maja in red and black and gold, dark horses in the night of Populacho in procession, black like insomnia. Our God is a mule, a muted blinding cry, a wall of darker fire. It is said poetry completes what history leaves out. Black like death, my beloved, my beloved. I'm so glad we live in peaceful times. Let me read you an extract, a passage from a book that's just been published called Notes from the Middle World, a collection of essays. This one that I want to read you a small part of is called The Pity and the Horror. In 2004, a number of writers, at that point we were grouped in an organization called the World Parliament of Writers, went to Palestine as a sign, as a gesture of solidarity with Mahmoud Darwish and his fellow Palestinian writers and poets. We traveled together. It was José Saramago, Juan Guti Solo, Bei Dao, the Chinese poet, Russell Banks, myself, Wole Soyinka from Nigeria, a poet from Italy, and it was a very remarkable, maybe that's not the word, it was a very disturbing experience. And when we came away after spending a little over a week there, we traveled both to the West Bank and to Gaza. We had agreed among ourselves that each one of us was going to give account of what he'd seen. And mine took the form of an open letter I wrote to General Ariel Sharon, which was published in various newspapers in Europe and I think here in the States by The Nation. It drew a lot of attention or criticism from many people. It was a very harsh letter, obviously. And then, a number of years later, Mahmoud Darwish, whom I'd known over the years, and we'd been in many places together, reading together at many different festivals, and spent some time together in France, he died. And reflecting on his death, and writing about it, and I'm going to read two of the poems that I wrote after his death and a kind of a continuing dialogue with him. But writing about his death, I remembered this original letter I'd written to Sharon, so it became one essay called The Pity and Horror, and I'm just going to be reading the last part of it. The news of his death, that's Mahmoud Darwish, brought anguish and pain that were nearly unbearable. Again, some of us had had the luck only a few weeks earlier of listening to him reading his lines in an arena in Arles. The sun was setting. There was a soundless wind in the trees, and from the neighboring streets we could hear the voices of children playing. And for hours we sat on the ancient stone seats, spellbound by the depth and the beauty of his poetry. Was it about Palestine? Was it about his people dying? The darkening sky, the intimate relationships with those on the other side of the wall, soldier and guest, exile and love, the return to what is no longer there, the memory of orchards, the dream of freedom? Yes, like a deep stream, all of these themes were there, of course, since they so constantly informed his verses. But it was also about olives and figs and a horse against the skyline, and a feel of cloth, and the mystery of the color of a flower, and the eye of a beloved, and the imaginations of a child, and the hands of a grandfather, and of death, gently, repeatedly, terribly, by implication, mockingly even, longingly, death. Many of us were petrified. Maybe we sensed, I remember seeing Leila Shahid's downcast eyes and trembling lips, that this was like saying goodbye, like this. On foreign soil, time stopped there, and a lament was made nearly joyous in the ageless rhythm of the two Palestinian brothers in black on the string instruments accompanying the words coming to us from the earth and from a light blowing over that distant land. We wanted to weep, and yet there was laughter, and he made it easy for us, and it became festive. Afterwards, I remember, we did not want to leave the place. Light had fallen, but we lingered, embracing and holding one another. Strangers looked each other in the eye, fumbled for a few words to exchange some thoughts. How awkward it has become to be moved. I remember thinking how deeply he touched us, how generous he was, and how light. Maybe, had he known, he would have wanted to take leave in this way. No drama, no histrionics, no demagogic declarations. Maybe not even much certainty anymore. Despair, yes, and laughter. The dignity and the humbleness of the combatant. And somehow, without us knowing or understanding, he's wanting to comfort us. He said he was stripping his verses of everything but the poetry. He was reaching out even more profoundly than he'd ever done before for the universally shared fate and sense of being human. Perhaps he was trying to convey that it was now time to remember to die. The next day when we left, when we said goodbye in that hotel Norpinus with its huge posters of corridas and the photos of bullfighters fragile like angels and the intimacy of preparing for walking out into the blinding light with the sweet smell of death lilies in the foyer, I wanted to kiss his hands and he refused. Time will pass. There will be eulogies and celebrations. He will be official. A voice of the people. He knew all of that and he accepted it, and sometimes he gently mocked the hyperbole and the impossible expectations. Maybe the anger will be forgotten. Maybe even the politicians will refrain from trying to steal the light of his complex legacy, his questioning and his doubts, and perhaps some cynics abroad as well would this time not disgust us with the spectacle of their crocodile tears. Mahmoud is gone. The exile is over. He will not have lived to see the end of the suffering of his people, the mothers and the sons and the children who cannot know why they should be born into the horrors of this life, the arbitrary cruelty of dying. He will not fade away, not the silhouette in his dapper outdated clothes and polished loafers, not the intelligent eyes behind the thick lenses, not the teasing, not the curiosity about the world and the intimacy of his reaching out to those close to him, not a sharp analysis of the foibles and the fallacy of politics, not a humanism, not a good drinking and a many cigarettes, not the hospitality of ever imposing his pain on you, not the voice that spoke from the ageless spaces of poetry, not the verses, not the verses, not the timeless love-making of his words. In writing this, looking back over the few glimpses I could get of the horror and the pity, I just wanted to reach out to you. And as I write, another ghost image arises from the words on the page, the face of Yehuda Amichai, the Israeli poet, a friend of mine and a friend of Mahmoud's. I remember a poem he'd written of an Israeli father looking for his lost son and a Palestinian shepherd looking for a lamb gone astray, both of them walking over the bare yellow hills of the Valley of Death, and how their calls echo and meet. I told Mahmoud in Arles how I want to propose to my fellow poets that we should, each one of us, declare ourselves honorary Palestinians. He tried to laugh it away with the habitual embarrassment of a brother. Perhaps without meaning to, I was blundering into areas of shyness and of a sadness that had stained the folds of the land too deeply to be talked about. Was he not also thinking of the voices in Amichai's poem, and indeed, our attempts to approach and understand the inconsolable can only be puny and clumsy. We cannot die or write in the place of his people, in the place of Mahmoud Darwish. Yet somehow, however futile the gesture, I needed to try and say that the gift of his poetry is of importance to all of us in the world, that it grows from a particular light and soul, certainly carrying the articulations of a very specific struggle and a life that had become word, but that it is also reaching out to our universal consciousness and condition, and that it would be an honor to try and understand ourselves through an understanding of where his poetry came from. It was already too late. He was leaving. He was gone. But by sharing these fleeting moments with you, I'm sure we're celebrating the dignity and the beauty of his life. Some of you, I know, probably cried, as I did then, and I'm doing now, when you heard of the death of the poet so far away from home, in Houston of all places, and most of you never even met him. Maybe as we cry for what is lost, we will pause somewhere because we hear a flutter of birds overhead and hold a protecting hand to our blinded eyes as we search the sky for that darkened rhythm. I want to finish with, have it, two little extracts from a series of poems that I wrote for Mahmoud in a continuing dialogue after his death, using very often his own rhythms and his own images and his own lines, making them my own, hoping to evoke in this way the voice of this person who had left. Mid-morning in heaven above West Hill, with moon a perforated dipper of light, dredged from time, bone bleached by gospel tides of verbs become verbiage to stool in stone the size of a dream, which only goes to show that since the outset of stellar configurations there's been a door to life in the dark out there. O watchman, you lying low in the lee of your blindness to leer at the light in our salt and the shimmering of rose roosting our wounds, if you were to gaze on the gazetted faces of the dead, you'd remember gossamer mothers in gas chambers and know this is not the way to recover your identity. You standing in the doorways of our demure dwellings, come inside from the blind binding out there. Come darken our thresholds. Come rest your whitened eyes so that we may know ourselves as people just like you. Come, come drink Arabic coffee with us and you will see us weep and fit into coffins just like you do. And then the last one. There's a reference in there that perhaps I need to just draw your attention to. I talk of a place called the Boerkaap. The Boerkaap is a quarter of Cape Town, the so-called Malay quarter, traditional, where people, the descendants of people who were brought by the Dutch company, trading company, brought from the Far East, some of them as political exiles, some of them as indentured laborers, some of them as slaves, and they were actually the craftsmen, the people who built Cape Town and built the surrounding towns. So there's a little reference to that. We shall be a people, if we will, when we know we're neither angel black nor white, and that evil is not the exclusive dominion of the other. We shall be a people if we do not disarm to darken the skies with popular posturing every time a poor person gets a bite to eat. We shall be a people when we bleed and mock the Sultan and the Sultan's courtesans and clowns and councils of state without being dragged off to court. We shall be a people when a poet erotically praises the dancer's belly as bleach as a shell and as sweetly salt as an oyster. We shall be a people once we forget the dictates of the tribe, so the citizen on his knees may enter the private kingdom of everyday love-making life. We shall be a people when the writer looks at the stir of stars without crowing that our mother regions are more vertiginous and fairer than a cock pecking at the moon in water. We shall be a people when a vice squad shields the whore and the adulterous spouse against a thwack of stones and slap of sticks on the street. We shall be a people when a singer like a canary may chant the surat of Rahman at the mixed marriage in the Burqab. We shall be a people when a patriot raises the colors only on sport fields and a beauty parade and to remember the great flight. Justice, justice. And the victory angel on the town square submits the sacred constitution to the bonfire's forgetting flames, and we be gorged on the stench of scorched verses and plumes. For we shall be a people, O my people, when we recognize the exact beat of life's passion and death's urge to dance and learn to respect the danced confusion. Thank you.
Concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
My poetry, my poems nearly always happen in Afrikaans first. It's very much the mother tongue.
Do you dream in Afrikaans?
Yeah, I do, but I dream in quite a number of languages at the same time. And oddly enough, you know, sometimes how you dream actual words and you either speak or you hear somebody speak. And I've often woken up immediately afterwards and found to my surprise that there were three or four languages in that one sentence. And they fit together without any grammatical uncomfortableness, let's put it that way. They just move together. So then the poems happen in Afrikaans and then immediately go over. Yeah, I'm not quite sure whether I should call it translate, because I think if one does it oneself, you're relieved of the duties and the responsibilities of a translator. You can innovate. If you can't find a word or it doesn't work in a new version, you just do something else with it. But Afrikaans still happens first in dreaming and in high drunkenness and in great anger.
You were once describing to me what a great language Afrikaans was, and you told me, I wonder if you remember this, about the speech in Hamlet where he sees his father. Do you remember that? What did he say? What art thou, my father's ghost? And how does that go in?
And when my puppy's a spook, yeah, it came out. Yeah. Which came out.
Art thou mine, bist du mein puppy's spook?
That would be in German, yeah. Yes. It's a lovely story of, I had a friend, a wonderful, wonderful old man, poet, writer, great translator. He was a great translator, a guy called Eus Kriche. And he was from the Cape, from an old Cape family. He was a great translator from Spanish particularly. He translated Lorca and Huidobro and Neruda and all those people. He was in Spain during the Civil War as a correspondent, then went into captivity. Second World War, escaped, wrote a beautiful book called The Way Out about his escape from a prison camp. And he was also a translator of Shakespeare, but he was a very talkative guy. He was always talking. He was always, you know, you could never stop. So the translated ended up one third longer than the original. He just liked it so much he couldn't stop. He couldn't help himself.
And maybe talk a bit about a different kind of translation, which is I talked about how you died three times. It seems to me you also live in three different modes in which you translate into each other, which are to say three P's, painting, poetry, and politics, and how they translate into each other. You could talk a little bit how they mirror and refract off each other in your life.
All words starting with P in English can be very dangerous. Yeah. I can think of quite a number of terrible ones, as I'm sure many of you can also. And power is one of the horrible ones, which I try to avoid using.
How do they? That all three of those, you're subverting power.
Yes, of course. I think that is, and maybe the perversity of it is a pleasure. and it certainly is a privilege. So,
could you pamplify on that a bit?
Well, perhaps, as I was thinking before peeking to you. how do they talk to one another and how do they overlap? I'm not sure what it is with you, because I know that you are as prolific a writer as I am. If not more so, and posterity will be the witness to that. But I don't think one pauses too often to look back and try to understand how come you did this and why did you move from one mode into the other. I don't think somehow that one has enough time. I don't feel I have enough time. For me, though, I think there is a kernel, or say there is a central concern that probably runs through all of these. Obviously, the one of working in what I call, for lack of a better definition, the broadening or the extension of consciousness. It may be partly to do with curiosity, it may be partly to do with the thing that we all are afflicted by, of trying to understand what it is that we're here for and how the hell did we came to be here? How did this mess came about? How did we become pawn? but I think also
born
consciously,
or pawn?
but also I think quite deliberately, because I'm intensely aware of the various textures of consciousness. Writing and painting partake very much for me of the same processes. You see, now you've introduced a damn P and we're not going to get rid of the other thing. But in a sense that it is, I think, quite intensely aware of the textures of the material that you use at the time. I believe that obviously there's a narrative line both in the painting and in the writing. Obviously, there's a tremendous need and an urge to tell yourself in the making of yourself, and perhaps to tell the world to the extent that you understand it, and perhaps to try to remake it as you move along, because there's that tension as well. The terrible anger with the world and what people have done to the world and what we are doing to the world. And that's perhaps where the politics comes in. Mm-hmm. But it is also quite intensely aware of the materiality of the discipline that you are involved in. And how that in itself, the silences, the breaks, the ruptures, the rhythm, the patterns that are being made, the colors that one uses, are ways of becoming more aware of the world in which you actually live. So for me, there's no problem really moving from one to the other. Obviously, they are received differently and by different publics, let's call it that. And I still have great difficulty when I show my paintings, for instance, people say, yeah, well, that's fine, but you're a writer, aren't you, really? Or if a writer says, yeah, you can, I can see you should really be painting. it's always easy when you get people...
You said that you can't in retrospect see it, but when you wake up in the morning with a particular... One of the things that was so striking about the paintings we were looking at...
These are watercolors.
The watercolors
are... They're not very big, but they were made for this particular book, yeah.
But they strike one very much as poetical constructs in the sense that they feel like concentrates or distillates of... Yeah. Of a poem,
yeah.
And conversely, many of your poems are just filled with word imagery.
Yeah.
But when you wake up in the morning with a particular word, image, whatever, do you know that that's going to be a painting or that that's going to be a poem, or is it going both directions? Or
it's definitely two different ways of working, in a sense that to be painting is a far more pleasant exercise than to be writing.
There's that great line of Thomas Mann that a writer is someone for whom writing is more difficult than it is for other people.
That's very interesting. But there's also another aspect that I picked up somewhere and that I sometimes repeat to my students. They're writing students, not painting students, and they don't like it when I tell them that writers don't actually live very old, and they tend to become more and more paranoid and even... other forms of delirium as they grow older. In other words, writing is a narrowing and a closing of the mind, whereas painting is exactly the opposite. Painting is an opening up, a broadening up. If you see the later work of Matisse or the later work of Picasso or Titian or, all of these painters, in a great old age, they become wonderful, loose-limbed masters of carelessness and of happiness. And they live much longer than
increasingly crabby and crabbed.
Exactly. And think of poor old Robert Walser, who claims he can't write anymore because he's got a cramp in his hand, and he writes smaller and smaller and smaller pieces of paper. It's a terrible vision to have. And there's something important about that, and that is when you are painting, you are physically in contact with the material that you're handling. And you can actually see that, and you can even perhaps lie to yourself and think you're actually working. That's a workman's day. You work until the end of when the light starts fading, and you look at it and you say, "Wow, what a great job I've done today. I'm tired. I've earned my keep. I can go. I can go and have a meal now. I've actually earned that."
It reminds me, by the way, before
because we go, you can't do that with writing.
Yeah. Before we go further on this, I should point out that one of the very peculiar aspects of your imprisonment. Was that this being, at the time, thought of by his wardens as one of the great Afrikaans poets, and the Afrikaners in those days constituting themselves as a culture and claiming that was a very important reason for their existence. Not only were you allowed to write, but you were required to write while you were in prison, in triplicate and so forth. Mm. But you were forbidden to paint.
Yes.
Why do you think that happened?
When after the first 2 years of solitary, when they staged a second trial, and it was clear then after this first 2 years why I'd been kept in solitary, because they were hoping that I'd be trying to make contact with the outside world and lead them to other activists and parts of the underground that they hadn't yet uncovered. But when that didn't happen, when the only thing that these 2 years produced was drawings and a few poems smuggled out of prison, they took me to court again and had me accused a second time, charged with terrorism. And during this court proceedings, we used that very much to try and make public, to make known the conditions under which I was kept. That's how I was given permission to write. But they never allowed me to paint because the thinking was that if you paint, you produce something. You actually produce an object. And that can be used to smuggle, to trade in prison. You'd be buying favors. You'd be exchanging it for tobacco or for fruit or for whatever else you needed. And for some other reason, they were desperately concerned with trying to stamp out any and all possible means of people trading.
You also once told me that you thought that one of the reasons might have been because they must have realized that for you, an empty canvas would have been...
Yes, of course. Also, they had the mistaken conviction concerning poetry that if you see something on a page written, then you can understand it, if it's in your language particularly. and you can probably control it. You can neutralize it. But with an image, they thought they couldn't do so.
And also it's an open field of freedom.
It's an open field of freedom, and they probably knew that they'd be fools, that I'd be painting things that must have been horribly subversive, and they couldn't stop it because they couldn't read it. It was a sad exercise in misunderstanding. When I was not long after that second trial, when I was given permission to write, I was also given permission to some extent to read. And a book of mine had been printed during the time, had been published during the time I was in prison, called A Season in Paradise. It had just come out in a translation. And the publishers from abroad wanted me very much to...
By the way, a gorgeous book.
Yeah, well, they wanted me to be able to receive the book, and it was, of course, the International Red Cross had to intervene to exert pressure on the South African prison authorities. And ultimately, I was given I was permitted to read the book, or at least to take it in my hands. But they had arranged for a kind of a Kafkaesque mise-en-scène. I was to sit in a corridor with the warder, so we could both be under surveillance. I was allowed to hold the book in my hands and turn the pages, but I was not allowed to read it. So the warder was watching my eyes carefully to see that I was just glancing, turning the pages. And the reason I was not allowed to read it, they'd actually read it before, and it underlined heavily the passages which were subversive, and they were afraid that I may be badly influenced by the subversive literature that I'm reading. Nothing like keeping one pure in prison.
And then what was fascinating also is that they wanted you to be writing, but they would take away your day's writing at the end of each day, so
That's
you couldn't
right.
refer back.
That's right.
And in fact, you basically wrote a remarkable novel under those conditions, Mourgoire, which is one of your recent publications with Archipelago.
Yes, it was reprinted by Archipelago, yes. But I think...
Imagine writing a novel where you are allowed to write a page, but then you have to give it to the warder. And by the way, it's registered, so you'll get it back at the end.
Yeah.
But you are, yeah. And that is the conditions under which that, and by the way, a fascinating title, Mourgoire, which is both mirror and dying.
And dying. And it's also the old French word for a place of dying, which I didn't know at the time.
Oh, really?
Hospice, in other words.
Really?
It still is use in that sense. Yes, but I think that accounts for the oddness of the book in that you start reading, if you have the patience to read it, and you move from page to page into areas, the names of the characters change and the environment changes and all that. The interesting thing, of course, is what is left over. What do you go with? It quite inadvertently became, I suppose, very much a postmodernist exercise.
So you're suggesting that the Afrikaners invented postmodernism?
I'm suggesting...
a laboratory test.
I'm suggesting that writers should not be allowed to reread what they do and it should be taken away from them.
But I do want to, having talked a little bit about poetry and a little bit about painting, to talk more about politics.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that was quite striking, perhaps, to members of the audience was your phrase, how you are immensely proud, if for nothing else, that South Africa has abolished capital punishment.
Mm-hmm.
I think your feelings about what's happened in South Africa are much more complex and subtle and convoluted, and even your feelings about what was happening during the years of revolution of the struggle than we're used to hearing. And maybe you could, I think for starters, it would be surprising for people to realize that you didn't go in incognito in support of the ANC, for example, that it was more complicated than that.
Yeah. Well, it's, of course, a terribly long story. But, the ANC, the African National Congress, which is now the party in power in South Africa, or the alliance in power in South Africa, it consists of three components. The ANC proper, the trade union movement called COSATU, Congress of South African Trade Unions, and the South African Communist Party. And that was already the case during the exile years and the struggle years. But the African National Congress, like most other liberation movements, was very much an umbrella organization, a national liberation front. And having within its ranks people all the way from very traditional background, traditionalists, Christians, probably people who consider themselves conservatives, through the middle ground, liberals, Democrats of different kinds, and moving on to socialist, leftist, communist, and even people to the left of the Communist Party, which is where I was. A very uncomfortable place to be, if I may say so, in the sense that since the ANC had no ideological coherence apart from the national liberation that we were all hoping to achieve, and it became later on clear it was much more of a black nationalist movement than was the case during the exile years. And by the way, if I make a little footnote there, people tend to forget that Nelson Mandela in his earlier years was a very strong proponent of not having any people of any other races in the ranks of the ANC. He was very much of a black nationalist at the beginning. Mm. He's also the person who introduced Thum Kontwe Sizwe, the armed wing, the notion of armed struggle as opposed to the Gandhian struggle, which is the one that had been practiced before that. Of course, then his 27 years in prison changed a lot of those things, many of his own thoughts about that. So it always had these incoherences. Now, the ANC, to be able to survive in exile, underground in the country, and it was very weak in the country itself, and the imprisoned component, the people on Robben Island, essentially, which became a very powerful space of freedom, of free thinking. I was reminded of that recently again when somebody, an old friend of mine who spent 10 years there, Neville Alexander, was also not a member of the ANC. He was also to the left of the ANC, but he ended up as a political prisoner, described how consciously people were preparing the kind of country in their minds and in training one another and in discussions and in debates that they were hoping to bring about when the time came. So
the sort of thing, by the way, that's happening in Israeli prisons today, where the Palestinian nation has been incubated.
I'm sure Barghouti and other people must be doing that. So, but it was dependent for its official existence in the outside world on support, obviously, and its essential support came from the Soviet Union, came from the socialist countries, and came from communist parties in other parts of the world. The ideological, the go-between to be able to get the support and to get the financial support to a large extent, to get the arms and to be able to handle the propaganda was essentially the South African Communist Party, which is why we ended up, and I must say immediately when I say these things, I'm speaking my own mind. I'm not necessarily giving you objective truth. It's obviously an interpretation, although I'll be able to argue vigorously why I say what I say. But I believe that although the African National Congress was never by intent a Stalinist organization, in fact it is deeply impregnated by Stalinist culture. And we see this is really what we are, to some extent have inherited in the country now. We have quite a significant and quite a visible shift over the last 2 years away from the agreed upon and the negotiated institutions of democracy, parliament, the constitution, the judiciary, a human rights commission, all of these things, administration. We have a shift of power out of parliament back into the party. All decisions pertaining to the country, all the political decisions, and that goes right down to the appointments at the local level of mayors of towns, for instance, is taken by the Central Committee of the African National Congress. That's where the inside fighting is taking place. And of course, the party, and they say so quite openly, is not responsive to parliament or to the larger political arena out there. And this has become quite devastating. Together with this, we have an historical occurrence, which is not of the choice of the African National Congress, because it happened to other organizations and to other parts of the world, and with even more effect, as in the case of Eastern Europe. When the African National Congress comes to power in 1990, well, it's a period from 1990 to 1994 when it's finally established in power, in the beginning with a government of national coalition. When it comes to power, it's also the end of the Soviet Union, the falling of the Soviet Union, and it's the breaking away of Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Poland, etc., etc. The African National Congress, which until then was really embodying a strive, as it was worded in the Freedom Charter, for what would have been, in effect, been a socialist South Africa. a country that belongs to all living in it, where freedom will be available freely to everybody living in the country, where there will be no racism, where, you know, people will be given the means to survive, et cetera, et cetera. All of a sudden finds itself coming to power without having a backup, without having an international community, without having an alternative, and then switches completely from nearly from one day to the other and become the guarantor of the free market system. And what this means in practice is that we have had the extremely rapid and very vulgar enrichment of the cadres of the party, the top people, who overnight become millionaires, what we call the boardroom revolution, the essential capitalist structure of the South African economy not being touched at all.
In fact, isn't it the case that the polarization of wealth is worse today?
It's worse. The gap between rich and poor is worse than it was in 1989 or in 1990. And of course, the anger among the people who haven't seen the results of the revolution or of liberation or of a majority government. And let me stop there a moment, because I think it's important. It's very important to always remember that when I say things like this, I'm perhaps not saying loudly enough the things that have been achieved. After all, we do have a government that represents a majority of the people in the country. We do have a constitution, although it's now losing its relevance. We have put an end to capital punishment, although now we have people being executed on streets because there's a great attempt being made by the police to recapture the streets. We have a very violent society. Recently, during an attempted armed robbery, actually a highway robbery, 11 of the robbers were executed in cold blood right there. Not a single one of them survived. So the question may be, people are no longer kept in cells to sing the last week and then being hanged, but now they're just being shot on the street. So we have this immense enrichment of the top echelons of the African National Congress. We have the African National Congress strengthening its hold on the country, because the only way you can make a living in the country, or the only way you can have influence in public life, become a director of a company, or be the head of a drama society, or get a senior position in the national broadcasting company, you have to be a member of the party, or at least a supporter of the party. In other words, it now becomes a matter of perks, privilege, nepotism, and one's own interest, with the gutting of the political content that the party had. But you have next to that, or with that, this immense majority of the people living in absolute poverty, crime-infested areas. What people don't know is that we have had over the last number of years something like 10,000 uprisings in the townships, in the squatter camps, you know, in the small informal settlements, where people are chasing away the officials that have been foisted upon them by the party in power, because there's no delivery. We have, you know, power cutouts, people are still looking for water, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, what this means is that the whole national arena is ripe for populist exploitation. And this is starting to happen now. We have younger people coming up still wearing the cloak of the African National Congress, particularly the young people responsible for the African National Congress Youth League. And they have become very, very populist. You know, the story that we should not be where we are today if it hadn't been that Mandela was turned around by the whites while he was in prison. Thabo Mbeki had never been enough of a black nationalist. He sold the country down the river, et cetera, et cetera. And this exploiting of legitimate anger at the economic poverty and the misery in which people live, which I think is becoming very, very disturbing as we go down. And with that, of course, we've also unfortunately come to the stalling of the nation building that had been occurring, or at least it had been tried under the reign of Nelson Mandela. The African National Congress that I supported, and in fact I was even officially a member, but that was after the 1990s. For a few years, in the early years, I actually had a card, an African National Congress card, but then that's beside the point. part of the purpose of the liberation struggle has always been to promote the coming about of a South Africanness, of a new concept of what it means to be a citizen of that country. South Africa has always been a construct ever since the beginning of its history. It's never been a whole. It's never been a natural, geographical, or historical, or economic whole. And over the years, over the centuries, many people tried different things. They tried colonialism. They tried apartheid. They tried union after the Boer War. And then, of course, now we're in the process of trying liberation. We're in what was called National Democratic Revolution, which is unfortunately not a revolution. So within this context, I think it is clear that one had to keep on moving forward to build this nation. If you stop doing that, it falls back in its constituting components with all the anger and with all the and with all the disillusionment that comes with it. And that's what's happening. The whites, to a large extent, the coloureds in the South African parlance means people of mixed origin, and the Indian people, Indian minority, are to some extent, to a large extent, depending, excluded from public political life. And the racism is re-emerging. It is very, very virulent again in the country. People are again talking very ugly to one another. You have a lot of crime that is literally racist, of racist intention, etc. So,
I shudder to think, is there hope?
There is hope in, with everything that I say, one must also always keep in mind what has been achieved, and that creates to some extent its own memory and its own space. And people do have in living memory that it is possible to resist oppressive regime. It is possible to resist arbitrary government. It is possible to resist good governance. The ANC is not doing itself a favor by imposing the government that they do on the country, because we have within living memory the extreme importance of what we call civics. The old regime, the minority regime, was brought down not by armed struggle and not really by international isolation and not by the ANC in exile. It was brought down by ANC-aligned and allied civic organizations inside the country, trade unions, church groups, women's organizations, youth organizations, all of these. And people have a memory of this. People know the importance. People know the thrust that this can have. For instance, the most effective non-governmental organization in the country is called TAC, the Treatment Action Campaign Against AIDS, HIV/AIDS. And the people who run this, or the people who are in charge of this, are actually old ANC people. They realize the strength because they realize the government was, you know, permitting genocide to take place, to call it that, by not recognizing AIDS for what it was, for all kinds of very convoluted and very, very paranoid reasons, and not allowing the necessary medicines to get to the people. And now we've had literally probably something like 2.5 million people already died. We're the country where we have an infection rate of around about 21% of the population. And most of those people are under 35 years old. And most of them are women. We had a national lowering of the expectant life expectancy by 10 years. It's now in the middle 50s, where it used to be just over 60 years. So the people who have finally forced the government to take account of this is called TAC. That's exactly a revival of the old civic spirit. And same thing is starting to happen in other fields. So there's a hope there. There's a hope in the sense that while all of this is going on, we have tremendously fine and vigorous thinkers and activists that are still alive in various niches of public life. We have some fantastic, great black intellectuals working in newspapers. Kolela Mankhu, for instance, Sipho Sehepi, and other people. Muletsi Mbeki, the brother of Thabo Mbeki. And these people are taking on the government head on. You know, they're taking it head on. It's very, very difficult because, you know, they risk losing their jobs, and to break ranks is really frowned upon. But I think the thinking is still there. It is still latent. It's a country with tremendous vitality. It's a country that still has within its grasp the potential of what it is. And that potential comes, whether the people in power like it or not, that potential comes essentially from its completely hybrid and diversified makeup. It's in this rubbing up against one another of these people of such totally different origins, coming from the Far East, coming from other parts of Africa, coming from all kinds of European countries, etc. It's in this, in this kind of a creolization of cultures, of which Afrikaans, the language, is an indigenous example. It's a profoundly Creole language. This in itself, I think, must throw up the means and the possibilities of moving forward.
We have almost no time left. I have two more questions, and you can answer them with one-sentence answers. Or longer, whatever you want.
The first comes
precisely from that Afrikaans question. What is the role of poets and painters in that struggle? Hmm. One sentence. But your comment about Afrikaans, I think, is a clue to that.
You know, obviously writing plays a far lesser role now than it did before the end of apartheid, mainly because we had such a strong moral case, obviously, when we were fighting apartheid. And so many people involved in it, among the writers, were actually from within the community in power, so they could sap the very foundations upon which the community tried to justify its rule over the majority. And that was a wonderful feeling. You could be really subversive. That poem I read about the torture that came up in court. Yeah. In fact, I was forced in court to apologize in public to the prime minister. In the meantime, the man had become prime minister. And I had to apologize. I don't know. I suppose if I hadn't apologized, I wouldn't have had 9 years sentence, but maybe death, whatever the case was. I mean, that was that directly related. Poetry and writing no longer has that kind of impact. But at the same time, South Africa has always been writer's land and to some extent probably painter's land as well, too. Although it's so spectacularly beautiful, it's very difficult to paint it. I don't know how people paint this country here. It's so beautiful. I can't see how they do it. But in any case, it doesn't have the same purpose now. But at the same time, even so, to the extent that what bedevils us, what we are fighting, are this close, intimate intermingling of notions of identity, of notions of memory, notions of imagination, and with that, notions of ethical responsibility to ourselves, to the people among whom we live, because of the extremes of poverty and richness, because of the struggle. All of these things, that's the bread and butter of writing. That's the bread and butter of creativity. So, yes, I believe that the writers and the painters and the filmmakers and the musicians are in the process of reshaping something very resilient, something that's very diverse.
An open field of freedom.
An open field of freedom. And as it says in this leaflet, which I thought, or this little book that comes with this reading series, the human right to the freedom of imagination. Yeah. I think it's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. And one last thing very quickly, just in terms of having mentioned Darwish. There's a great deal of discussion right now about whether it is proper to talk about what's going on in Palestine, in Israel, mm-hmm. as apartheid. To what extent do the similarities or differences draw you in particular to that struggle?
I was going to read that little piece where I tried to make the point that I find comparisons always iniquitous, obviously. Mm-hmm. Because it's a way of reaching for easy emotional gratification, and it tends to smooth over the texture, the specificity of each situation. I never agreed with the notion of calling apartheid Nazism, for instance. I think apartheid was bad enough in its own right to be described in its own way, and similarly, what Israel is doing to the occupied territories should be described, however painful it is, within its own historical context of it. But having said that, obviously, yes, the striking thing that hit me when we went there to the occupied territories is exactly, yes, it reminded me in so many respects of what I knew from South Africa. It was in some respects worse because the area is much smaller. And in a way, I felt that the anger was more face-to-face. People were right up against in each other's face all the time. Sitting at a roadblock, for instance, in the occupied territories, for hours, when one realized that the sole purpose was to literally drive mad the poor people sitting in their cars with their families, waiting for them to get through. That kind of gratuitous, nearly intimate violence, I didn't quite remember from South Africa. I didn't quite see it happening that way. And of course, the fact that there's this attempt to cut up the occupied territories in manageable enclaves, that's Bantustan politics. That's Bantustan politics. There's no two ways about that. And of course, there's the racist component, which one felt very, very powerfully there. We talked about it, and I've talked over years to various Israeli friends about it. You know, the question would be, if I had to speak as an Afrikaner, which I don't, I do now, I do sometimes, because I believe that it does not make sense to try and continue seeing the Afrikaners as one homogeneous group that are born in racism, live in racism, will die in racism. They bastards, they are hybrid people. In fact, half of the Afrikaner people, more than half of the Afrikaner people, are officially considered colored people. So this is nonsense, you know. So when people, you know, if you're going to discriminate against somebody because he's a Jew, he's going to answer as a Jew. If you're going to discriminate against me as an Afrikaner, I'm going to stand up and say, okay, well, screw it, I'm an Afrikaner. You know, and I'm going to use whatever I have at my means as an Afrikaner, and I'm going to fight it in that way. So we had this conversation, and so with my Israeli friends, it would be, you guys were stupid to give it away when you had it all. And the argument would be from the South African side, don't you see that you could actually change matters without having to kill one another? Don't you see it is possible to have a peaceful transition? Which is true. Which is something that I'm very proud of, which is something fantastic that happened. South Africa actually moved from where it was, which we all know more or less what it was, to where it is now. And it's not perfect. And its first few years were absolutely wonderful. It can be done. You cannot survive by trying to repress another people forever. It just doesn't work. It's not possible.
Well, I think actually that's not a bad note to end on.
And especially, I want to thank you, though, first of all.
Okay, you can thank me, but you can do that privately. We can thank them for having endured all this, and we'll see you out in the back in a few minutes.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.